Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. If you're new to the channel, please like and subscribe. If you're enjoying what you see, make sure to hit the notification bell as we're constantly adding new episodes and doing cross streams with other channels and adding additional programming. Speaking of additional shows, tomorrow I'll be gentrifying White Guy Wednesday once again while the resident white guys are on a bit of a hiatus. I'll be with another white guy that some of you may know, JG Michael from the Parallax Views podcast, and we will be discussing two underrated classics, Psycho 2 and Psycho 3. The Anthony Perkins directed Psycho 3. It'll be a fun movie podcast show. Also, before we start, for you audio only listeners, Apple is offering a subscription service. So if you're enjoying the show and don't want to figure out Patreon, you can have access to the Champagne Room by just subscribing to the show on Apple Podcasts. Also, thank you to all the YouTube and Twitch subscribers. You guys are the fuel and the TIR engine that keeps us going. If you would like access to past and present Champagne Rooms, be part of the live virtual audience for the Pascal Robert hosted Mau Mau Hour, and also be able to join us for movie nights. There's only one way: become a patron for as little as $3 a month or $30 for the year. It can all be yours. Now that that is out of the way, let me bring in this anti-ADOS cast we have here today with all these black people. They're just going to make me go full ADOS. That's what they want to do. I think that's the plan. Maybe I need to bring Cedric and Teray on for more shows. We have more Black American shows. These are all jokes, by the way. Not serious. Coming all the way live from Miami, Florida, he is the man of the Mau Mau Hour. You know him as having some of the most popular shows on this channel. He is the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. How are ya? How are ya?
I'm feeling good. I'm working on this new setup here for the show. We got the soundboard back.
Did you enjoy watching Kamala Harris dance to 80s hip hop on the weekend at her domicile?
I don't want to admit out loud what I enjoy when I watch Kamala Harris.
Well, listen, she went to Howard and she plays a black sorority, so I did expect that she could dance. I wasn't disappointed.
Oh yeah. I try not to watch that, but when you did Fat Joe, he gave her something, or was somebody
Fat Joe gave her a pair of Terror Squad Nikes.
Jesus Christ. Between Fat Joe and KRS,
I feel like it was so transparently pandering. And when the guy who was announcing the performers got on the stage and said, "Let me introduce Vice President Kamala Harris, our first Vice President of the hip hop generation," it was almost vomitous. It was really incredible. It was it was like watching the Black Professional Managerial class in full, just total.
Say it. You don't want to say it out loud. You're afraid they're going to come get you.
The merging of the anti-status quo hip-hop with the Biden administration, to the point where Kamala Harris says that hip-hop is the most American of art forms. I was like, fight the power, Chuck D, baby.
Are you afraid to speak out against the Black PMC because they're like the Illuminati, and that's who the Illuminati really is?
Black PMC, they're too incompetent to be like the Illuminati. I knew too many of them personally. So
speaking of the Black PMC, she's coming all the way live from a borough in New York that shall remain nameless. She's the faceless voice of reason. Please welcome M. Toussaint.
Hello, hello. Just want to say, one never goes full ADOS.
you never go full ADOS.
Never.
I think people actually believe that when I say that, which would be really silly, being that you two are Haitian.
I think they consider you like an Adolf traitor or something like that.
Adolf.
Oh, Marcus is Jamaican.
Yep.
Marcus is Jamaican. Yeah.
There could be only one. Maybe I'm more like Highlander. It's less Adolf and more Highlander. That can be only one. Well, let's bring in our guest because Pascal, I hit Pascal up early this morning. I wanted to make sure he read the review. And he was like, oh, yes. He's like, this is very, what did you say?
I said fruitful.
Target rich environment for questions. As he typed that back to me, I could hear his hands like this, ready to go with the questions. Since the victory of anti-communism and the fall of the left has allowed identity politics to take a space as a revolutionary ideology, the book Elite Capture posits IDPUL as a leftist ideology that was captured by elites, while ignoring that IDPUL has always been an elite project. Race management functions to manage inequality by placing working class solidarity second to the sins of racial, ethnic, or religious discrimination. Has the creation of race allowed us to obscure class antagonisms in the name of identitarian struggles? Are 1619 and 1776 projects two sides of the same conservative anti-communist coin? Our guest today, Zine Magubane. In her latest for Catalyst writes, the term intellectual common denominator was coined by sociologist C. Wright Mills to describe an idea of such iconic status that men can state their strongest convictions in its terms. The term legacy of slavery meets that criteria. The 1776 and 1619 projects both wield slavery as an ideological weapon, seemingly in service of opposing social aims. The 1619 project argues that because slavery was the foundation upon which American society and its inequity was built, reparations must include individual cash payments to descendants of the enslaved in order to close the wealth gap. The 1776 Commission maintains that slavery was an unfortunate aberration in a nation founded on the rights and freedom of the individual. John C. Calhoun in the Confederacy rejected this in favor of the idea that rights and privileges inhere not in every individual by the laws of nature and nature's God, but in groups or races according to historical evolution. As such, the 1776 Commission draws a parallel between people who argue in favor of reparations and the defenders of slavery. Both seek to sacrifice equality and private property in the name of group rights and explicit group privilege. If you'd like to read that full piece, you can find it in the latest issue of Catalyst Magazine titled The Class Politics of Race. Please welcome Professor of Sociology at the College of Arts and Science, Dr. Zine Magubane.
Greetings, Dr. Magubane.
Hi.
You're cutting off part of the top of natural.
Okay. I don't want to do like what Cornel West does. It's a very odd Zoom angle. Right? I'm like, great content, but Cornel, move the camera down.
Speaking of reparations, there's an LA Times article that came out a couple days ago that says that Californians are not for reparations, as Governor Gavin Newsom, I believe in 2020, had put together a reparations task force, kind of like the Mod Squad, and trying to figure out if they want cash payments. So it's not that they're against reparations, the voters of California. They're against cash payments as part of reparations for descendants of enslaved Africans in California. Did you read that, Zine?
No, I'm afraid I missed that one.
You don't get a reparations newsletter?
I do not. I don't fall into Ado's categories for someone in Southern Africa. So join my Haitian compatriots as people who are ineligible for.
Look, I would just try to just go, hey, just throw on your thickest Boston accent. Pascal, you want to go ahead and start off? I know you have a bunch of questions.
I do. I'm very much looking forward to this. thank you again for agreeing to come back to the show. We love you and your work here at TR. Your latest is a book review of Kenan Malik's latest Not So Black and White, A History of Race from White Supremacy to Identity Politics. This book has some polarizing reviews. What prompted you to write about Not So Black and White, and why do you think this history is relevant today?
Sure, thanks. So the reason I wrote for it is because Vivek Chipper, whose work I admire very much, as one of the editors of Catalyst, and he asked me if I would be interested in doing a review of the book. I read the book and thought that it had a really interesting premise in that it argues that there is, first of all, it makes the point that identity politics of the left and the right often actually meet in the same place. And he identifies across a long sweep of historical time, the ways in which identitarians on the left and the right, in their agreement on the primacy of race over all else, even despite some surface dissimilarities in some of their arguments, they oftentimes really end up on the same side of the ledger. So he goes through this really long sweep of history, and to do the book review, they were like, don't do a standard book review, chapter one says X, chapter two says Y, but rather do something that kind of uses the book as a launching point to talk about larger issues. And what I was struck in that argument of how the identity politics or identitarians on the left and right can on the surface be arguing something that seems to be different, but they actually agree on some very fundamental things, I was struck by the fact that the 1776 Commission, which was written as a response by the Trump administration to Hannah Nicole Jones and the whole 1619 project. And again, they would seem to be radically opposed, right? You know, everything about what they think about slavery to what they think about race in America, it would seem on the surface that they're radically opposed. But I actually saw that if you dug underneath the surface, there were certain fundamentals upon which they agree. Most of those fundamentals having to do with capitalist social property relations, private property, and class or historical materialism as an analytic.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about that statement, Professor Magomani, is that if you look back to your earlier piece on Booker T. Washington, who some would argue, and you correct me if you believe I'm wrong, is the father of modern identity politics in dispatching it largely to protect capitalism and a class revolution, if you will, in the populist era in the South, that hierarchy of utility was financed by people who at the time would be considered liberals, right? The lords of capital of the late 19th century, the Gilded Age period, the Roosevelts, the Carnegies, and so forth, would have been considered the liberals of their age compared to, of course, the Dixiecrats of the South. Mm-hmm. Oh, the irony is that their financing of all of these race-based initiatives was actually not left. It was conservative in that they were trying to protect the traditional hierarchies of capital by using race as a buffer to neutralize class politics amongst Black and white and challenging capitalism. So the truth of your point that there are similarities between the right version of identity politics and the left version of identity politics shows how that line from Bookerism to today kind of split and rationalizes both sides. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. Linking the first piece that I did in Non-Site to this latest Catalyst piece, what has increasingly intrigued me is the class politics of anti-racism, which is something that like Touré Reed has talked about, Cedric Johnson, Adolf Reed, much more in the contemporary era. As a historical sociologist, I'm really interested in tracing the class politics of what we would call anti-racism today back through historical time. And what I found out in the course of this examination is the degree to which people like to believe that anti-racism is an inherently progressive stance or is inherently somehow radical or anti-capitalism. Actually, what I found is that anti-racism has its own class politics, and the versions of anti-racism that are often the most amplified are precisely the ones that argue that the route to racial equality, that the brightest and shiniest and straightest road to an anti-racist society is to travel along the capitalist path. And and when I was looking at that comparison between 1776 Project and 1619 Project, I was fascinated by how in their invocation of the past and in their sort of using these two historical dates to argue for a particular politics in the present, even though many of their political solutions are at dire odds, they both fundamentally agree in the sanctity of private property. And it comes through so strongly, again, despite so much of their political programs things seemingly being opposed or being on opposite sides.
That's absolutely fascinating. Let's move on with our questions. How, this is a great question by Jason. How do we get beyond the idea of white privilege when so many people are wedded to its existence? Does this ideal of white privilege support quote unquote white supremacy?
I want to add to this. I was having a conversation with a friend and somehow white privilege came into the conversation. And I was like, that's stupid. And he goes, what do you mean it's stupid? And I was like, explain to me the privilege of what white people have. And white skin privilege. I was like, okay, well, so a homeless white person has privilege? And he said, yes. I was like, really? So you know, a homeless white person sitting in their own feces, urine-soaked pants, getting stepped over and by everyone in society, literally and figuratively, sleeping on the cold street, eating out of garbage cans, been homeless for the last 7 years, is really sitting there thinking to themselves, I may have open sores all over my body and a disease that should have been cured centuries ago, but at least I'm not an N-word. Is that what you're telling me?
So, yeah, I, my deepest sympathy is that you had to have that white privilege conversation with anyone, because it's one of those things that once somebody is dug in on that position, no amount of logical argumentation will move them off of that position. And secondly, oftentimes you're actually arguing about, you might say the arguments go quite past one another. Mm-hmm. They will, after you talk about the homeless person with the sores, they might grant you that, but then begin to talk about disparities, which is their favorite analytical framework for supporting the idea that white supremacy is not only a thing, but is the primary thing that must be battled. They so love the disparities framework because it allows them to point to the fact that Black people across the class spectrum can potentially suffer disproportionately any number of ills from whether it's like traffic stops to, you know, maternal morbidity, whatever it is. And they move from that to a jumping of, therefore, class trumps race. And some of their favorite things to bring out are, for example, when Venus or Serena went to the hospital and, you know, suffered terribly, X, Y, and Z, right? And the problem with that, when you try to argue with people with that, is indeed some of those things are true. Indeed, that thing did happen to her. Indeed, you might show, you know, the disparities framework shows that X, Y, Z, you know, Black people so-called suffer disproportionately. The problem with that type of, there are two problems with those type of framings, is they tend to be rather imprecise about the mechanism that produces the disparate outcome. They're not particularly interested in, well, because to them it seems self-evident. It's obviously got to be racism or discrimination. Mm-hmm. The thing is that they actually then, which of course no one would ever deny, is a thing. Racism and discrimination are certainly true facts of life. Mm-hmm. However, when we are talking about the areas of inequality that are most painful, that are quite deadly, generally, the reason that those disparities exist, the reason that they exist, the mechanism comes from the fact that the market is allowed to distribute goods and bads in our society. And in a capitalist system, the delivery of any good or service, whether it be education or healthcare, whatever, the delivery of that thing is secondary to the production of profit. So for example, like a Venus and Serena, that hospital wherever she gave birth, the immediate, she's Black, she almost died, it's racism. All sorts of other things disappear from view, or let's not even have heard things like maternal morbidity, right? Yeah. What disappears from view is America has the highest rate of maternal morbidity in the world for people, regardless of ancestry. Why do babies not die in like Scandinavia and all sorts of other places? It's because of our profit-driven healthcare system, right? It produces terrible outcomes. We spend the most money, we have the most people die, whether it's, you know, people giving birth, whatever it is, people suffering from obesity. When you focus on disparities, you never actually get to the mechanism, which tends to be universal, that it is delivering a disparate outcome, which people who are poor suffer from disproportionately. And again, that disparities framework tends to evacuate capitalist socialist property relations, not only from the analysis of the problem, but for the proffered solution. Right. So just to sort of wrap it, I'll let you ask more questions. When people put forward, for example, the Black woman dying disproportionately in childbirth, it is rare that a solution offered is socialized medicine. In the 1619 Project book, it's kind of listed along with a long list of things. But what tends to be foregrounded is things like sensitivity training for doctors, or we need more Black doctors, without a mention of, gee, how did medical school get so expensive anyway, right? Just capitalism is evacuated as a source of most of the misery in the world.
You know what's interesting is when you said that we need more Black doctors thesis, it harkens me to arguments people have made that like, we need more Black lawyers. And it was a study that came out about legal systems in municipalities that are controlled by Blacks. In other words, they have high rates of Black judges, ooh, high rates of Black prosecutors, and high rates of Black public defenders. Not only is there no demonstration that there is an amelioration or decrease of incarceration by the presence of Black judges, prosecutors, or public defenders, but in some cases, if you read that book, you know, Locking Up Our Own in D.C., it shows that, you know, these Black PMC were railing to lock up, you know, Black folk by the baker's dozen.
But that's because white supremacy started it all.
Well, people then might say something like internalized racism, right? The problem with most of these arguments is their mechanism is psychological. It's psychologically driven because they don't have any real grasp of or appreciation for political economy. So when I did the review of Malik's book, I just, you know, there's a part of the book where he discusses the 1930s as this really critical moment in American history where the strong presence of, you know, socialist organizing and communists in the anti-racist struggle, you know, that Scottsboro Boys case where basically the NAACP was very wary of getting into bed with the Reds, right? They were like, this is not something that we want to do. And basically the era where kind of Cold War civil rights mostly focused on achieving legal equality within the constraints of the capitalist political economy eclipses a more, you know, socialist, class-based, working class-based, anti-civil rights struggle that also has a very deep critique of capitalism and recognizes that you're not going to get rid of racism until you do something about capitalism, right? So he talks about the 1930s as this really important moment where that Cold War civil rights agenda becomes predominant. And what I noticed was, you know, that's also, there was a really interesting quotation I found from a historian who talked about the impact of, you know, going from the 1950s onward, really accelerating, the impact of anti-communism on the American Academy, not just in terms of like the lives of professors, but the epistemological frameworks that would be promoted and given prominence. And so what I saw when I went to analyze the, you know, the similarities between the 1776 project and the 1619 project, another thing that came forward really strongly was both of them relied on social science research. The 1619 project particularly jumps out to me as a sociologist because they quoted a couple of prominent sociologists, people who have a very race reductionist type of framework, like people who talk about organizing world history in terms of racial projects, people who talk about racial formation being more important than class formation, people who speak about race, class, and gender as salient identities that sort of somehow translate into analytical categories. And when class is translated into an analytical category, it just becomes an identity. It doesn't actually become about a class analytic. So I noticed that both the 1776 project and the 1619 project were deeply informed by analytic frameworks that took off in the realm, in the era after the Cold War, where again, political economy is just pretty much evacuated from two of the disciplines that need it most, mainly, in my opinion, sociology and history. I mean, it's needed in economics, but I mean, that's just a pipe dream. That's never gonna happen. But there was at least a possibility of them being retained in sociology and history. And, you know, race reductionism, ahistoricism, and analyses that do not have any political economy in them tend to go hand in hand.
I'd like to ask you a question on that point, and this line of questioning may seem provocative, but I'd like to. Do you agree or believe that there is a materiality to the way in which race is lived in the United States? In other words, are there certain material ways in which race, and it doesn't have to be black, for example, Native American, Hispanic, if you will, are there particular material ways in which these identities demonstrate material harm within the context of the United States?
I would rephrase the question so as to avoid what my favorite historian of all time, Barbara Fields, calls the race racism evasion. And her point is that the word race is a neutral sounding term with the ugly fact of racism hidden inside. From there, she jumps to say, racism is as real as gravity. It is a real thing. Racism is a real thing. It's a horrible thing. It's a denial of the humanity of another, oftentimes with violent and deadly consequences. Mm-hmm. Race, however, she says, is indeed an ideological construction. To say something is an ideology does not mean you don't think about ideologies in terms of real or fake. Ideologies, as she and other, you know, Marxist scholars have, you know, very persuasively argued, is ideologies are the sort of social stories, social tales, social scripts in which people live, enact or live out the social relations in which they are embedded, right? It is an expression in words and thought of the material social relations in which people live. So again, to think of them in terms of real or fake is not all that useful. Rather, the question is to say, if we take race to be an ideology, right? Look at it as an ideological formation, to understand what type of a society, what type of social relations have produced the ideology in this form. But when you go in terms of discussing material things that can be struggled, fought for, changed, you are, if you really want to fundamentally transform a society, you have got to go to the social relations. So I guess when you say, well, is it material? Yeah, racism is quite real. It doesn't mean that race is material in the way that a certain group of sociologists like to talk about that, especially because they jump from race being material to so-called races having material interests. And our good friend Cedric Johnson, I think, has just completely demolished this idea of anodyne racial interests.
No, I agree with that. I think that the notion that there's some kind of biological race, united racial concept of we all have one united interest is ridiculous, just because it denies the class reality of race. But the reason I said, because one of the reasons why I bring forth this inquiry is that one of the things that has caused me to be an adherent of leftist praxis is the position of the Black communists and socialists of the 30s, the old left, in understanding that the way in which race functioned in the United States and how they particularly understood with things like, you know, the Negro question and Lenin's statement about race, how race functioned in the United States. I would, of course, realize that the 1930s are not 2023, and the way race shapes American society is not the same today that it did then. But the question becomes, how exactly do we create the multiracial coalitions to neutralize the harms cross-racially that capitalism causes in society? Poor whites, poor blacks, working class blacks, whites, Latinos, and so on and so forth. If we do not have, we do not find a way to discuss these realities without at the same time being pegged as identitarians, race reductionists, so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, I'm not interested in making racism the only problem in America, because it's not. I'm also not interested in making the problems of Black people disappear either. So the question becomes, how do you thread the needle while still maintaining your bona fides and loyalty to your dialectical materialist principles as a leftist?
Well, I guess, okay, how do people come together to engage in struggle against something that they agree is both causing them harm, right? I think that's one that's embedded somewhere in that question. I mean, whenever people seem to think that, you know, the racism of working class people or working class people or people is such an insurmountable barrier, I mean, I always answer, middle class people, of which I am one, and I actually very much like the people that I work with, but I've had sisters who work in corporate America. Middle class people often cannot stand the people that they work with. They cannot stand them. They do not like them, but they must go to their job to get a paycheck. This other thing that they need allows them to overlook the many things about certain people that they do not like. And to me, a struggle for some sort of material end, I don't like you, but we both agree we would like reduced working hours, longer vacation, you know, free health, whatever it is. Just as middle-class people every day go to law firms and overlook that they cannot stand the people that they are there with, wish them ill will, but hey, I need a paycheck. I want to pay my bills. I want to send my kids to school, and they get on with it. I actually think working class, you know, class-based struggle can be the same thing. I don't like you. I don't like the way you live. I don't like your face, but we're both struggling for the same thing and I need it. So I'm going to deal with you. And after we finish struggling for the thing, maybe we'll go home and be friends. Maybe we'll still not be able to stand each other, but we will have achieved getting the thing.
Will you live in segregated neighborhoods?
People, again, are very pragmatic, actually. At the end of the day, like, it's so interesting. They may have very strong ideological beliefs about X, Y, and Z. But at the end of the day, if you've got to get, you know, when people talk about things that are material things you need a house, you need food, you need X, Y, and Z. oftentimes you are able to make peace with things that you dislike. I mean, the life of a person in the professional managerial class, who again, I am one, is a life of swallowing things and doing things you don't want to do because you've got bills to pay and a lifestyle.
Tucson, you're the queen of the PMC around here.
And so I just think, you know, people's notion that the virulence of people's racial likes and dislikes are enough to fundamentally, especially when something starts to work, which again, we've seen in history. Why did large numbers of Black people desert the Republicans and go to the Democrats during the New Deal? I mean, they got into the party with lots of Southern races. Why? Because the New Deal had stuff they liked in it.
Well, that goes against the white privilege narrative that was, the New Deal didn't work. That was also part of the conversation too, that the GI Bill hurt Black people.
Oh, I wasn't too Ray Reed on for that one. I think I watched that.
No, movie. Another light-skinned person, that was Paul Prescott.
Right.
Apparently, Zine thinks you all look alike. So take that to Ray and Paul. Tucson, you're a resident Black PMC woman. Are you swallowing things you don't like at your job?
I just want to say that that's called brown skin privilege when you mix up light skin Black people.
Mea culpa. I can't call, like, it's the, what is it like? I have, again, anti light skin bias.
You and Jason have a lot in common.
I yelled at Bert Cooper today just for being light skin.
Just so, yes, it was. It was not Ture. It was the other smart light skinned guy.
You know what? Paul's coming on Thursday, and he will be very happy to know that he was mistaken for Ture Reed. Because Ture Reed won't even come on camera till his hair is right, and he's got to have the right lighting. And Paul just comes on with a camera phone and hope his Wi-Fi works.
Gotta get the Ricky Ricardo haircut perfect.
The Ricky Ricardo. I call it the alt-right fade. He's got, you call it the Ricky Ricardo.
In any case, I mix them up not because they are lightly melanated, but because they both have a similar class politics and very strong essay.
You mix them ends up because
in any case. Back to our discussion of when people are faced with material circumstance, mm-hmm. what they are, what principles they will hold on to that may match their ideological view of the world, and which ones that they'll be like, hey, you know what? I still believe the thing, but I want that thing over there. So, you know, I'm going to check this whatever belief for a moment. I think history gives us ample examples of that. And again, my example of the New Deal, which, you know, Ira Katznelson and others seem to want to say is affirmative action for white people. The 1619 Project also didn't like the New Deal. That was another place where the 1619 Project and the 1776 Project agree. They both cannot stand the New Deal. And interestingly, the 1619 Project says, we hate it because it was affirmative action for white people. The 7076 Project, and they're like, you know, instead we should have targeted race-based reparations for a specific group. The 1776 Project hates the New Deal because, you know, they say it's socialism and it goes against, you know,
their core beliefs of
giving
people stuff they didn't deserve.
Yeah, so it's interestingly, right, they both dislike the New Deal. They have opposite political programs on the surface, right? One wants reparations, the other one just wants the free market. You know, one wants the state out of the market, the other one wants to intervene in that market to deliver goods to one identity category. But they both agree that something based on universal social programs is bad, no good.
Well, the ultimate irony of this is that reparations poses no threat to capitalist property relations.
None.
Would you take a check, Pascal?
They don't mind.
I don't believe in reparations for Haiti. I don't believe in reparations for Haiti. I think reparations, unless you change the fundamental hierarchy of capitalism, is a complete trap.
Because would you cash the check, though? If one came to your mailbox at 1515 Black Man Way in South Florida, would you cash the check or would you throw it down and then say some curse word in Creole?
chick for how much?
The Gators want to know.
There's the clip right there. There's some more questions.
Cash
we have.
Is never coming. That's the thing. I mean, even the people that argue for it say it'll be a range of programs. I mean, it's been pointed out endlessly the serious political problem of how are you going to get a majority to fight for or vote for something, a benefit that is only going to go to one group. The same people who say that white supremacy is such an insurmountable obstacle, right? The Afro-pessimist crowd, the Black Panther, the case for reparations guy. Why am I blanking on his name?
Oh, Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, right. People who say that white supremacy is ontological, basic, fundamental, a driving force as great as gravity, somehow also believe that a country that is predominantly white and most people who would be voting for this thing wouldn't get it, would still get it. It flies in the face of law, would still vote it. It flies in the face of logic. So, I mean, that.
Well, I gave you California's example. You know, there was a whole reparations
of black people in California.
In California.
51% of black people in California did not believe that black people deserve cash payments for reparations.
It's not like all of them played for the Dodgers and the Rams. You know, the Lakers only got 24 people on a team. So,
well, did the article go into depth and ask people? And what did they
Why they didn't want to vote for it? No, I can give you like kind of demographic breakdowns, but
because there was no slavery in California.
There was no slavery in California, first of all.
I've heard that.
But I don't think that has anything to do with it because so many people from California are not, you know, we're all second generation from somewhere else. Did you want to chime in on white supremacy, Tucson? I know there's some white supremacists around you somewhere in New York. You're in New York.
Oh my gosh. Dude, they're everywhere.
I'm sure your super just knocked on your door, said white privilege, and just walked away. Like a doorbell bitch.
I'll just go with the next one.
Okay.
We are in a time when black elites, the black political class, and the racial entrepreneurs among the media argue that black people are under siege in the light of the politics of the reactionary right via voter suppression and attacks on other initiatives implemented in the post-civil rights era. How should leftists who root their politics in the political economy address such concerns?
Sure. Look, I don't think there's anybody who's leftist who would argue that, you know, an attack on voting rights is not an important issue. What I have found, though, is that in their search for some sort of issue that matches this notion of racial interest, they tend to focus on a couple of things that, although are important issues, often are not so visceral, you know what I mean? Or they don't have the same kind of galvanizing force for people that issues that they really don't want to touch might potentially have, right? So yes, who doesn't think voting rights are important? People think of things are extremely important. I wouldn't also say that they're not important. But people also do consider how does their medicine get delivered? You know, can they access healthcare, housing, their student loan debt? I mean, these are things that sit on people's shoulders every single day. And to me are key, you know, bread and butter issues that can not only unite people across identity categories, are, you know, salient real issues but how cannot be one, tagged conveniently as identity category issues. And two, they like identity category issues that you can have a lot of moral anger about, get very excited about, and potentially fix without really tinkering with capitalism that much. And I'll close with, it's quite interesting that even as far back, you know, that period of the 1930s, when the NAACP, where lynching was much more prevalent than it is today, even then the NAACP was having trouble galvanizing and building up the level of membership excitement and engagement around issues like lynching. Whereas issues having to do, again, with housing, healthcare, wages, issues rooted in political economy that are not, you know, race-specific issues, people had a lot more energy around them. And it was, there was a big meeting in 1935 where, you know, a prominent guy like Abraham Harris was, I think E. Franklin Frazier, you know, some more left-leaning Black sociologists at the time, they were discussing what is the direction, and people strongly saying a focus on issues of having to do with political economy is a place to is the next direction we should go rather than strictly race-based issues. And that was as early as 1935.
If you read the book, Where Do We Go From Here? It's a book written in the 1940s. It's an anthology of a variety of very well-respected Black intellectuals at the time who were talking about, what exactly are the needs of Black America? This is written in the 40s.
Yeah.
And what is ironic about that book, I forget the actual title off the top of my head. I wrote an article about that. But the book basically states many of its responses are rooted in class-based universal political economy. This book was written in 1944. I think it's What the Negro Wants. I think that might be.
Yes, exactly. That is that book.
Yes. And what's ironic is very few of the solutions were rooted in racial democracy, which are racial policies. And also going back to the great book by Preston Smith that demonstrates that the housing policy that was chosen by the Black professional managerial class or the Black political class of the 40s and 50s, that was racial democracy or race-based policy, always gave benefits to that class while denying benefits to poor and working class Black people. And people always ask, well, what's wrong with racial-based remedies? Well, let's look at what happened right after the Civil Rights Movement. One of the problems of the Civil Rights Movement is because of a variety of reasons. One of them is that Vietnam basically made the economic capacity of class-based remedies impossible. Is that many of the remedies from affirmative action, minority set-asides, and these things disproportionately benefited Blacks who were middle class or proximate to middle class, and the Black poor, unfortunately, suffered from mass incarceration, deindustrialization, and there was an increase, of course, in the Black middle class, but there was also a proliferation of the Black poor and what some pejoratively call the Black underclass. And we can make the argument that one of the problems with race-based remedies is they consistently, disproportionately give benefit to Blacks who are at the top of the food chain while leaving most Blacks who are working class or working poor at the bottom out. And it's much more effective to have a more class-based universal agenda to address those problems. Would you agree or disagree, Professor?
Well, I would absolutely agree. And I mean, again, even there's the disparities framework and the wealth gap, two twinned ideological constructions. What those people who argue in favor of viewing inequality in terms of the wealth gap, two things that they often fail to want to talk about. One is the vast majority of Americans, no matter what their census category, have no wealth at all, zero. The wealth gap is a problem of the top 10%.
Absolutely.
It is those people. And so, I mean, yes, the Black 10% and the white upward, 10%, there's a gap there. The white rich ones have more than the rich Black ones have. Another thing they tend not to like to talk about is a disparity that they don't like to talk about, which is the growing disparity between the rich Blacks and everybody else, which has exploded in the last 30 or 40 years, right? So again, these are things that just disappear from view as it is assumed that when one is talking about closing the wealth gap, that it's going to put money into the pockets of the poor. It is not going to do that.
Well, one of the reasons that we have this problem, and we talk about this often on This Is Revolution podcast, is that the discourse around racial politics is controlled by the Black political class and the Black professional managerial class, and that these folks very, very, very strategically map a Black political agenda that lines their coffers and has nothing to do with economic redistribution to poor and working class Black people. for example, if you look at the agenda that comes out of most of these administrations, whether they are Republican or Democrat, one of the most consistent policy agendas we've had in this country since the 70s is black capitalism, which, again, no one's saying we shouldn't have black people who own businesses or stores. But the point is that black, over the supermajority of black-owned businesses in America are owned by people who have at least 3 years of college education, and they're all self-employed small businesses. They don't even hire anyone. That's a fact. So the notion that this is going to be a salvation for 42 million black people is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's pretty nuts. But it has a tremendous amount of traction, right? Because it's just tied to a number of different, you can say, like, ways that thing that that are beneficial for the protection of capitalism. One, a focus on wealth disparities says that wealth is an inherently a good thing. It takes off the conversation about, gee, it's like accumulating large amounts of private wealth, good or bad. Question. Takes that off the table. Wealth is inherently good. Secondly, this notion of business classes as the saviors of the poor. It's trickle-down economics on steroids without even a clear mechanism, because it imagines somehow black business people are different than every other kind of business people. Business people want to make profits. Business people want to pay their employees little and keep much for themselves. It is the imperative of business. They imagine, weirdly enough, that somehow these black business people will either ignore the structural constraints of their business, or that somehow when businesses are operating the black community, the normal rules of capitalism don't apply. It's completely bizarre. But it has a tremendous amount of traction in the wake of Black Lives Matter. You know, they'd have these like 10-point programs or whatever. And one of the things that was going around, like on called Twitter at the time in Boston, was a list of black businesses to support, which is lovely for those people who own those businesses. But this notion of that it's somehow helping the black community, I mean, I just have to go back to Cedric Johnson and his deeply deep skepticism towards the notion of community. It's basically like a class-inflected ideological construct that goes along the idea of this community consciousness and community interest.
It's basically the assumption that 42 million people have the same amount of political unity as 12 folks at a diner.
Listen, you couldn't even get 12 folks at a diner to agree. Not the people I go to diners with.
Yeah, my favorite line, I think I got it from Cedric, is like, there are literally as many black people in America as there are citizens of Canada.
Canada.
You know, so I was like, do you expect, I mean, like, it's really, first of all, it's an elitist concept from the beginning, because we all know, we've all studied enough of, you know, black political history, particularly from the left analysis, that when you say black people are one nation altogether, well, who speaks for the nation? Where's the votes? Where's the election for the leader? Who gets to decide what the agenda is? I'm waiting for someone to tell me where was the ballot that told me that Al Sharpton was a black leader, because I never thought FBI informant number 7 was going to be a leader of black America. I grew up in New York.
That's literally.
I remember when Al Sharpton was fat and had a worse perm, you know?
Wow, this is getting personal.
Very personal.
I think you should go to a black diner, and then you'll see how the black people all agree that Off the Wall was a better album than Thriller.
And it very much goes back to Booker T. Washington. His notion was that the best of the blacks and the best of the whites would sort out the social relation, the society for all the rest. It is from him. He was the so-called first great Negro leader. So it is really dating from Booker T. Washington's time of this notion of race leadership, that a census category can have a leader, non-elected. And really what it translates into is the black guy in the room that white people want to talk and deal with, elite whites want to deal with. But again, and there is racism at play, this idea of racial mysticism, that black there are certain things, fundamentals upon which we all agree, and that there are these leaders who elevate somehow magically without being elected or asked, who articulate the silenced voices of all of the people. And it gets rehearsed every day on television, MSNBC, you name it.
Well, it's interesting, you know, to further extend your critique of the Black leadership conundrum is that Du Bois only took the Booker T argument and increased it by saying instead of having just one Negro, we'll just have a class of Negroes who are the talented 10th. So that's a little better than just one, because we could all argue that, you know, the talented 10th is naturally the better arbiter of things for the rest of Black America. And it's had horrendous consequences from the beginning. But the problem is that you won't recognize these realities as long as you are learning Black history and Black social and political history from the top down. In other words, as long as you hear Booker T was a great man, Du Bois was a great man, Martin Luther King was a great man, Malcolm X was a great man, you're always going to believe in his people. But unless you start to study Black working class history, Black movement history from below, then you start to realize that a lot of these guys were collaborating with the people who were busting up Black unions. A lot of these guys were collaborating with people who didn't want to see working class Black people have an opportunity to unite with forces, often those that were white, that would challenge capitalism. So part of the problem as to how we get to this conundrum of all of this talented 10th, you know, some call Boule, Divine Nine, aspirational nonsense, is the way in which we actually tell the history of Black social and political history to our children, which is also done by those elites, right? Because the people who are in the organizations that make up those class are the ones teaching in the Black high schools. They're teaching in the South. They're teaching at the HBCUs. So we continue this vicious cycle of forcing this Black version of life from above that does nothing but perpetuate this kind of horrible Black politics.
Sorry. That's why I've always been so interested, again, in the class politics of anti-racism, because you can see that people can be agreed upon that racism is a terrible thing that they'd like to do something about. Simply being anti-racist says nothing about the class content of your program, the class inflection of the discourses that you mobilize. It tells you absolutely nothing. And it's precisely through what you described as like history from below, telling the history of working class struggles, again, adopting, unlike the race reductionist framework, who sees global history as a series of racial projects, why don't you see the march of history as a series of class struggles or class projects? Or you see what I mean? Like this way in which the American Academy has evacuated political economy to a large degree and replaced it with, you know, not only race as the most salient and primary category of analysis, but a kind of way of thinking about race that denies class distinctions and class struggles within any particular racial category.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Jason, do you have any questions?
No, we're out of time. Tucson, because it was such a good show, that's why.
That's right.
Just remember that when you go on those other people's shows, and it's like, man, it's like watching grass grow. But when I'm on TIR, it just zooms right by. Well, the setup is back, and we can take phone calls again. So, in the champagne room, MT and I are going to be taking phone calls.
Yep.
Pascal and Zena, will you guys be joining us in the champagne room?
What is the setup is back? I don't know what that means.
It was a champagne room. Zena.
I mean, I remember the champagne room, but
I didn't have a computer for a while.
Oh,
Jesus.
You didn't have a computer. Oh. It was the light-skinned people that took your
we had too many
light-skinned people. Light-skinned people get free computers.
I knew it.
Bert sent me some email today that he got from, I won't say the publication, but he said, looks like you haven't ruined my career yet. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, yeah. Man. We tried, Bert. We tried.
You did. You did.
That's how powerful light skin privilege is. He can come on this show and we just say the most horrible things. And
that
he
was
keeps
a really good show. I enjoyed that. It was
we just said the most horrible shit. And he gets more and more gigs. And he showed me the latest one. I was like, I refuse to believe that this keeps happening to you. Awesome. It is literally because you're light skinned. And you have that mixed people hair. That's the only reason why. 30 years old, you still look like you're in a Gap Kids commercial.
Oh my gosh, the things you said. When do you come up with this stuff? You look like a Gap Kids commercial.
Well, we'll be going to the champagne room. We'll be taking your calls. We'll definitely be playing a few videos again. We love playing videos on contemporary hip hop and you guys telling me why it is still a thing.
50 year anniversary.
It's the 50 year anniversary of hip hop, so says someone, but not hip hop. Because Pascal was there at the first hip hop party.
That was
not. And the first Thanksgiving.
First Thanksgiving.
He doesn't look amused.
It's like that.
You know what we're going to do in the champagne room?
What?
Mosh people. Mosh people that were born before 1970.
Yeah, fuck those people. Everyone's parents.
Dina is one of those people, fool.
No, she's not. She's
yes, I'm you. Ancient.
She might be older than I am.
Yeah. Definitely,
I'm damn. No, you're younger. You're younger than Pascal. We found this out already.
No, what year did you graduate from college?
I graduated in 90.
91.
See? Okay, so it's quite close
enough. August birthday, maybe you're different. We're probably
one. I was born in December of 68.
August of 69.
Yeah, so
all right, so we were indeed at the first Thanksgiving.
It's still shocking to me that people consider our cohort in Generation X old. I was like,
we are.
I don't
now, know. Now, every time I look at Zine, all I see is that MC Light haircut.
I have a theory. Most of my friends who are academics concede, who are my age, concede that they're old.
Yeah.
I think that's purely a result of the fact that they have basically taught almost 2 to 3 generations of kids by definitely the time they are our age. There's nothing yeah old about you definitely guys. It's just that you have been teaching people who are basically teenagers for 30 years.
Yeah.
It doesn't make you old. It just it means does they're young.
30 years is a long time.
30 years is a very long time. It's like a very long
time. Not old.
We are old.
It went by old quickly.
Age but is not a social construct like race. Age is and
we're not old.
You're very old. Ask no, that to young old people.
Someone who's 75 is very old.
We're minutes away from 75. Like you're gonna look up and you're like, oh crap, I'm 70. Fast. Don't you notice time passes way faster the older that you get? Like you yes look up and you're like, wait, another year. Like, remember when you were young, how long it took your birthday to get there? It took forever. You'd be like, I'm 5 and a half, I'm 5 3/4. When's the last time you said I'm 52 3/4? It's like another birthday? What?
Can you please start telling people you are 55 3/4.
Right? I mean, I just remember that being little. 5 3/4. 5 7.
That's awesome.
I don't find this entertaining. Old.
No, you're just mature.
Generation X is not old.
I'm old. There's you're gray hair old everywhere now.
You think you're old because you have kids.
Jason, and you're younger than we are, Jason.
Yes. I can't do things that I did when I was young. I can't even
you eat. You could have said that at 35.
You can't even eat 35.
I can't do a lot of shit. I have to stop everything that was fun in my life. I have to cut that shit out. Fast food.
Pause.
Soda. You said boys? What did you say?
Pause.
Oh.
Pause?
That was a, forget it.
It's an inner city colloquial.
Probably better that I don't.
We're trying to make sure you keep tenure. We're not going to chew you like we do Bert Cooper.
See, JC Fire said, we are falling for the cult of youth. That's the problem. We say we're falling for the cult.
What if I just like being old?
You're not old. That's
true. You get to be a curmudgeon, which is
you do.
I was a I got a picture of me when I was 5. I was a curmudgeon then.
Yeah, but you were an asshole. As you get older, it's like, oh, that's just adorable. So you could be an asshole, then you're adorable.
A curmudgeon and an asshole are not synonymous.
No, not at all. A curmudgeon is like set in their ways, you know. It's a curmudgeon. A curmudgeon is something to aspire to.
It's the goal.
You're a curmudgeon.
I'm almost there. I'm almost there.
I've been called a curmudgeon a lot.
Dave said, if people call you sir, you're old.
Yeah, sir, ma'am, no question, ma'am.
My daughter's boyfriend calls me Pops or OG. So that, yep, that's what, old, when, definitely. When definitely. He came along, that's when I knew I was old. I was okay with
it. Yeah, yeah.
Somebody, no if question. I, somebody on this show ever calls me Unc, I'm getting a baseball bat.
Uncle Pascal.
Would do.
We're not
you got old. Everybody's uncle shirt on right now.
Everybody's uncle shirt. Yes.
Like if I was at a barbecue and you walked up, I was like, oh, that's the cool uncle.
Everybody's got jokes, man.
People call you Sir Pascal.
I think this show's definitely going to be canceled. There's anti-light skin bias. There's
Listen, you know why I don't feel old? I'm literally the same age as Roland Martin, and he looks 10 years older than me.
Oh, Roland with the shit skin.
That's fucked up, talking about poor old Roland Martin. That's the debate that Pascal really wants to have.
But there also sizeism in there because of Roland.
Sizeism? You just made that shit up.
No, it's definitely. The, people talk about sizeism.
They brought that up at the last diversity meeting at this campus.
Definitely diversity training. They definitely talk about, you know, discrimination against on the basis of age, size, sexual orientation, blah, blah, background, religion. Size is included.
Jason doesn't respect it. That's what that face means. I don't respect that one.
I don't respect that one. Fuck tall people. Punching all tall people in the nuts.
Anti-tall bias.
It's a tall bias. If you're tall and light skinned, two fists.
On that note.
On that note.
Jenny, you disappoint me. We're not old.
It's okay to be old.
What was that song? Oh God, that was an R. Kelly song about age only being.
Oh, age ain't nothing but a number.
An R. Kelly song. Oh, shit. I don't know how his construct about age being a social.
Oh construct. Yeah, yeah. See, R. Kelly, you ain't girl. You're not young.
Yeah, that was the line back in the day to the either older or younger woman. Age is a matter of the mind. And if you don't matter, I don't mind.
Oh, my God.
Gross.
Oh, that's what this shirt brings that out.
Yeah, what's wrong with you? Why do I have you snapping on my shirt, man?
It's her shirt. It's color brown.
No, you're making fun of the man's clothes.
Shirt is cool, man. What's wrong with you, man? It's a plaid shirt.
They
plaid.
Make fun of me all the time.
Well, just because Jason wants to show his taco meat every other episode.
He does. He does very much.
Taco meat is men's, black men's chest hair. Chest
black
hair.
Men's chest hair looks like
oh,
taco
I
meat.
Was not familiar with that.
It just hit her. It just hit her and she had a visual.
You've never heard taco meat before?
No.
She had a visual.
tactful meeting.
So not. Yeah.
She said yikes.
Every black R&B singer in the 80s just
right. Ray Parker Jr. The list goes on. Taco
Bell. Ray Parker Jr. Wow, that's like out of nowhere.
You people don't remember Ray Parker Jr.
If you remember Ray Parker Jr.'s anything other than Ghostbusters, you are a deep cuts Negro.
You got a couple of hits back in the 70s.
He wrote some songs.
I know he wrote some songs, but nobody knew that.
The old I'm in love with the other woman. That was one of his.
I'm in love with the other woman.
You know what this sounds like? Look, for the champagne room, we're going to open the phone lines and we're going to do some Black Yacht Rock. The link is already up. Black Yacht Rock, Pascal. It's what's for dinner.
Black Yacht Rock.
That song made that me Black 27. Yacht Rock,
no question.
That song made me $27.
Existence of that
$27, Pascal. $27 from Black Yacht Rock. From the spins on Black Yacht Rock.
Oh, God.
It's a popular song that the young people like.
Which is?
Black Yacht Rock. I wrote a song.
He wrote a song.
Oh, I thought it was like a playlist because definitely
there is a playlist called Black Yacht Rock, and I will be playing from it in the champagne room.
Ray Parker Jr. would have to be on that.
If Ray Parker Jr. wrote a song,
he said,
if Ray Parker Jr. is on it, then we have to crown you the queen of blackness.
You know what one of the songs on his Black Yacht Rock album is?
I don't have that album, so I'd love
to. Well, let me tell you the title of the song. The Negroes on the Vineyard are wearing Air Force Ones. It's a song.
Were you trying to like channel Gil Scott Heron in there? Like
the Negroes on the Vineyard are wearing Air Force Ones.
The songs are in order. Black. It's a 3-song EP, but it's 30 minutes long. So some of the songs are really long. Mm-hmm. It's Black Yacht Rock, the title track. Mm-hmm. It's These Negroes on the Vineyards are wearing Air Force Ones. Mm-hmm. And the conclusion song is Bill Cosby's Black Excellence.
I've officially been rendered speechless.
It's an ode to Black bourgeoisie excellence, mm-hmm, in all of its ironic glory.
Well, I'd certainly love to hear it. Is it available on iTunes?
It is available on iTunes and Spotify, wherever you listen to music. If you just type in Bitter Lake, that's the name of the project that, mm-hmm, I play all the instruments in, and it's all instrumentals.
Okay.
So while you're on your yacht, you got boat shoes on. Mm-hmm. You know, you're out there in Nantucket. You put it on, and you can Black Yacht Rock it up with the rest of the...
Jason is trying to surmise whether or not you party with the black...
Black bourgeoisie.
You don't do the vineyard thing? Good for you. Resist the energy. Resist. And you're in Massachusetts, too.
There's a lot of them, definitely. People who love it. I mean, August, that week in August, everybody goes. The week that Skip Gates gives that conversation on race at the Whaling.
Yes, I love it. You know, the irony is going to Martha's Vineyard to have a conversation on reparations. It's like it's the ultimate irony of these PMC Negroes. It's like, we're going to have a chat on reparations.
Well, they had a reading group on that book, Isabel Wilkerson's.
Yes.
Oh, they love that.
I think she did a signing at the bookstore.
Yeah. That might be a bonus track.
Let's spill all the tea in the champagne room.
Well, look, we're going to be there. The link is already up. We are. Wait a minute. Don't say it yet.
Out.